try to visualize life without Bertrand, to imagine it, the divorce, the lawyers, the aftermath, what it would do to Zoe, what your lives would be like. Separate homes, separate existences. Zoe going from you to him, from him to you. No longer a real family, no longer breakfast together, Christmas together, vacations together. Can you do this? Can you imagine this? I stared at her. It seemed unthinkable, impossible, and yet it happened so often. Zoe was practically the only child in her class with parents who'd been married for 15 years. I told Isabel I couldn't talk about it anymore. She offered me some chocolate mousse, and we watched Les Demoiselles de Rochefort on her DVD player. When I got home, Bertrand was in the shower, and Zoe in the land of Nod. I crawled into bed. My husband went to watch television in the living room. By the time he got to bed, I was fast asleep. Today was visiting Mame Day. For the first time, I nearly telephoned to cancel. I felt drained. I wanted to stay in bed and sleep all morning, but I knew she would be waiting for me. I knew she would be wearing her best gray and lavender dress and her ruby lipstick and her Shalimar perfume. I couldn't let her down. When I turned up just before noon, I noticed my father-in-law's silver Mercedes parked in the courtyard of the nursing home. That unnerved me. He was here because he wanted to see me. He never came to visit his mother at the same time as me. We all had our specific schedules. Laure and Cécile came on weekends, Colette on Monday afternoons, Edouard on Tuesdays and Fridays. I generally came on Wednesday afternoons with Zoe, and alone on Thursdays at midday, and we each stuck to our schedules. Sure enough, there he was, sitting very straight, listening to his mother. She had just finished her lunch, always served ridiculously early. I felt nervous, all of a sudden, like a guilty schoolgirl. What did he want with me? Couldn't he just pick up his phone and call me if he wanted to see me? Why wait till now? Masking all resentment and anxiety behind a warm smile, I kissed him on both cheeks and sat next to Mame, taking her hand, as I always did. I half expected him to leave, but he stayed on, watching us with a genial expression. It was uncomfortable. I felt like my privacy had been invaded, that every single word I said to Mame was listened to and judged. After half an hour, he got up, glancing at his watch. He darted a strange smile at me.
"I need to talk to you, Julia, please," he murmured, lowering his voice so that Mame's old ears wouldn't hear.
I noticed he seemed nervous all of a sudden, shuffling his feet, glancing at me with impatience. So I kissed Mame farewell and followed him to his car. He made a motion for me to get in. He sat down next to me, fingered the keys, but did not turn on the ignition. I waited, surprised by the anxious movement of his fingers. The silence thrived, full and heavy. I looked around us at the paved courtyard, watching nurses wheel helpless old people in and out of the premises. Finally he spoke.
"How are you?"
he asked with the same forced smile. "All right," I answered. "And you?"
"I am fine, and so is Colette."
Another silence.
"I spoke to Zoe last night while you were out," he said, not looking at me.
I studied his profile, the imperial nose, the regal chin. "Yes," I said, warily.
"She told me you had been doing research."
He halted, the keys jingling in his hands.
"Research about the apartment," he said,
finally turning his eyes to mine. I nodded. "Yes, I found out who lived there before you moved in. Zoe probably told you that." He sighed, and his chin sagged upon his chest, small folds of flesh covering his collar.
"Julia, I had warned you, remember?" My blood began to pump faster.
You told me to stop asking Mame questions, I said, my voice blunt. And that is what I did.
Then why did you have to go on prying into the past? He asked. His face had gone ashen. He was breathing painfully, as if it hurt him.
So it was out now. Now I knew why he had wanted to talk to me today.
I found out who lived there, I went on heatedly, and that's all. I had to know who they were. I don't know anything else. I don't know what your family had to do with the whole business.
Nothing, he interrupted, nearly shouting. We had nothing to do with that family's arrest.
I remained silent, staring at him. He was trembling, but I could not tell whether it was anger or something else.
We had nothing to do with that family's arrest, he repeated forcefully. They were taken away during the Veldiv roundup. We never turned them in, did anything like that, do you understand?
I looked back at him, shocked.
Edouard, I never imagined such a thing. Never.
He tried to recover his calm, smoothing his brow with nervous fingers.
You are asking many questions, Julia. You are being very curious. Let me tell you how it happened. Listen to me. There was that concierge, Madame Royer. She was friendly with our concierge when we lived on the Rue de Turenne, not far from the Rue de Saint-Ange. Madame Royer was fond of Mame. Mame was nice to her. She's the one who told my parents the apartment was free in the first place. The rent was good, cheap. It was bigger than our place on the Rue de Turenne. That's how it happened. That's how we moved in. That's all.
I continued to stare at him, and he continued to tremble. I had never seen him look so distraught, so lost. I touched his sleeve, tentatively.
Are you all right, Edouard? I asked.
His body shook beneath my hand. I wondered if he was sick.
Yes, fine, he answered.
But his voice was hoarse. I couldn't understand why he looked so agitated, so livid.
Mame doesn't know,
he went on, lowering his voice.
Nobody knows, you understand? She mustn't know. She mustn't ever know.
I was puzzled. Know what? I asked. What are you talking about, Edouard?
Julia, he said, his eyes boring into mine. You know who the family was. You saw their name.
I don't understand, I murmured.
You saw their name, didn't you?
He barked, making me jump.
You know what happened, don't you?
I must have looked completely lost because he sighed and buried his face in his hands. I sat there, speechless. What on earth was he talking about? What had happened that nobody knew of?
The girl,
he said at last, looking up, his voice so low I could hardly hear.
What did you find out about the girl?
What do you mean? I asked, petrified. There was something about his voice, his eyes, that frightened me.
The girl,
he repeated, his voice muffled and strange.
She came back a couple of weeks after we had moved in. She came back to the Rue de Saint-Ange. I was 12 years old. I'll never forget. I'll never forget Sarah Starzinski.
To my horror, his face crumpled. Tears began to trickle down his face. I could not speak. I could only wait and listen. This was no longer my arrogant father-in-law. This was somebody else. Somebody with a secret he had carried within him for years. For 60 years. It had been a swift metro ride to the Rue de Saint-Ange, only a couple of stops and a change at Bastille. As they turned into the Rue de Bretagne, Sarah's heart started to beat faster. She was going home. In a few minutes, she would be home. Maybe while she had been away, her mother or father had been able to come back, and maybe they were all waiting for her, with Michelle in the apartment, waiting for her to return. Was she crazy to think that? Was she out of her mind? Could she not hope? Was that not allowed? She was 10 years old, and she wanted to hope. She wanted to believe, more than anything, more than life itself. As she tugged on Jules' hand, urging him up the street, she felt hope grow like a mad, wild plant she could no longer tame. A quiet, grave voice within her said, "Sarah, don't hope. Don't believe. Try to prepare yourself. Try to imagine that nobody is waiting for you, that Papa and Maman are not there, that the apartment is all dusty and dirty, and that Michelle. Number 26 appeared in front of them. Nothing had changed in the street, she noticed. It was still the same calm, narrow road she had always known. How was it possible that entire lives could change, could be destroyed, and that streets and buildings remained the same, she wondered. Jules pushed the heavy door open. The courtyard was exactly the same, with its green leafiness, its musty smell of dust, of humidity. As they made their way through the courtyard, Madame Royer opened the door to her loge and poked her head out. Sarah let go of Jules' hand and dashed into the staircase. Quick now. She had to be quick. She was home at last. There was no time to lose. She heard the concierge's inquisitive, "Looking for anybody?" as she reached the first floor, already out of breath. Jules' voice followed her up the steps.
"We are looking for the Starzinski family."
Sarah caught Madame Royer's laugh, a disturbing, grating sound.
"Gone, monsieur, vanished. Won't find them here, that's for sure."
Sarah paused on the second floor landing, peering out onto the courtyard. She could see Madame Royer standing there, in her dirty blue apron, with little Suzanne slung over her shoulder. Gone? Vanished? What did the concierge mean? Vanished where? When? No time to waste. No time to think about it now, thought the girl. Another 2 flights to go before home. But the concierge's shrill voice floated up to her as she rapidly ascended the stairs.
"The cops came to get them, monsieur. Came to get all the Jews in the area. Took them away in a big bus. A lot of empty rooms here now, monsieur. You looking for a place to rent? The Starzinskis has been let out, but I might be able to help. There's a very nice place on the second floor. If you're interested, I can show you."
Panting, Sarah reached the 4th floor. She was so out of breath, she had to lean against the wall and press her fist into her aching side. She pounded on the door of her parents' apartment, quick, sharp blows with the palms of her hands. No answer. She pounded again, harder with her fists. Then she heard steps behind the door. It opened. A young boy of 12 or 13 appeared.
"Yes?" he asked.
Who was he? What was he doing in her apartment?
I've come to get my brother, she stuttered. Who are you? Where's Michelle?
Your brother, said the boy slowly. There is no Michelle here.
She pushed him aside brutally, hardly noticing the new paintings on the entrance wall, an unknown bookshelf, a strange red and green carpet. The astonished boy shouted, but she did not stop. She rushed down the long, familiar corridor and turned left into her bedroom. She did not notice the new wallpaper, the new bed, the books, the belongings that had nothing to do with her. The boy called out for his father, and there was a startled scuffle of footsteps in the next room. Sarah whipped the key out of her pocket, pressed on the device with her palm. The hidden lock swung into view. She heard the peal of the doorbell, a murmur of alarmed voices drawing near. Jules' voice, Genevieve's, and an unknown man's. Fast now. She had to be fast. Over and over she mumbled, "Michelle, Michelle, Michelle, it's me, Circa." Her fingers were trembling so hard she dropped the key. Behind her shoulder, the boy came running, out of breath.
"What are you doing?" he gasped. "What are you doing in my room?"
She ignored him, picked up the key, fumbled with the lock. She was too nervous, too impatient. It took her a moment to work it. Finally, the lock clicked, and she tugged the secret door open. A rotten stench hit her like a fist. She drew away. The boy at her side recoiled, afraid. Sarah fell to her knees. A tall man with salt-and-pepper hair burst into the room, followed by Jules and Genevieve. Sarah could not speak. She could only quiver, her fingers covering her eyes, her nose, blocking out the smell. Jules drew near, put a hand on her shoulder, glanced into the cupboard. She felt him wrap her in his arms, try to carry her away. He murmured into her ear,
"Come, Sarah, come with me."
She fought him with all her might, scratching, kicking, all teeth and nails, and managed to scramble back to the open cupboard door. In the back of the cupboard, she glimpsed the small lump of a motionless, curled-up body. Then she saw the beloved little face, blackened, unrecognizable. She sank to her knees again, and she screamed at the top of her lungs. She screamed for her mother, for her father, screamed for Michel. Edouard Tézac gripped the steering wheel with his hands till his knuckles turned white. I stared at them, mesmerized.
"I can still hear her scream," he whispered. "I cannot forget it, ever."
I felt stunned with what I now knew. Sarah Starzinski had escaped from Bonne-la-Rolande. She had come back to the Rue de Saint-Ange. She had made a hideous discovery. I couldn't talk. I could only look at my father-in-law. He went on with a hoarse, low voice.
"There was a ghastly moment when my father looked into the cupboard. I tried to look too. He pushed me away. I couldn't understand what was going on. There was this smell. The smell of something rotten, putrid. Then my father slowly pulled out the body of a dead boy. A child, not more than 3 or 4. I had never seen a dead body in my life. It was the most heartbreaking sight. The boy had wavy blonde hair. He was stiff, curled up, his face resting upon his hands. He had gone a horrible green color."
He stopped, the words choking in his throat. I thought he was going to retch. I touched his elbow, tried to communicate my sympathy, my warmth. It was an unreal situation, me trying to comfort my proud, haughty father-in-law, reduced to tears, a quivering old man. He dabbed at his eyes with unsure fingertips. Then he went on.
"We all stood there, horrified. The girl fainted. She fell right to the floor. My father picked her up, put her on my bed. She came around, saw his face, and backed away, screaming. I began to understand, listening to my father, to the couple who had come with her. The dead boy was her little brother. Our new apartment had been her home. The boy had been hidden there the day of the Veldiv roundup on July 16th. The girl thought she was going to be able to come back to free him, but she had been taken to a camp outside Paris."
A new pause. It seemed endless to me. "And then? What happened then?" I said, finding my voice at last.
"The old couple came from Orléans. The girl had escaped from a nearby camp and had ended up on their property. They had decided to help her, to bring her back to Paris, to her home. My father told them that our family had moved in at the end of July. He did not know about the cupboard, which was in my room. None of us knew. I had noticed a strong, bad smell, and my father thought there was something wrong with the drains, and we were expecting the plumber that week.
What did your father do with the little boy?
I don't know. I remember he said he wanted to take care of everything. He was in shock, terribly unhappy. I think the old couple took the body away. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
And then what? I asked, breathless. He glanced at me sardonically.
And then what? And then what?
A bitter laugh.
Ha! Julia, can you imagine what we felt like when the girl left? The way she looked at us. She hated us. She loathed us. For her, we were responsible. We were criminals. Criminals of the worst sort. We had moved into her home. We had let her brother die. Her eyes, such hatred. Pain, despair. The eyes of a woman in the face of a 10-year-old girl.
I could see those eyes, too. I shivered. Edouard sighed, rubbed his tired, withered face with his palms.
After they left, my father sat down and put his head in his hands. He cried for a long time. I had never seen him cry. I never saw him cry again. My father was such a strong, rugged fellow. I was told that Tezak men never cry, never show their emotions. It was a dreadful moment. He said that something monstrous had happened. Something that he and I would remember our entire lives. Then he began to tell me things he had never mentioned. He said I was old enough now to know. He said that he had not asked Madame Royer about who lived in the apartment before we moved in. He knew it had been a Jewish family, and that they had been arrested during that big roundup. But he had closed his eyes. He had closed his eyes, like so many other Parisians, during that terrible year of 1942. He had closed his eyes the day of the roundup, when he had seen all those people being driven away, packed on buses, taken God knows where. He hadn't even asked why the apartment was empty, what had happened to the family's belongings. He had acted like any other Parisian family, eager to move into a bigger, better place. He had closed his eyes, and now this had happened. The girl had come back, and the little boy was dead. He was probably already dead when we moved in. My father said that we could never forget. Never. And he was right, Julia. It has been there within us. And it has been there for me. For the past 60 years.
He stopped, his chin still pressed down onto his chest. I tried to imagine what it must have been for him to carry that secret for so long. And Mamet, I asked, determined to push Edouard on, to drag the entire story out. He shook his head slowly.
Mamet was not there that afternoon. My father did not want her to find out what had happened. He felt overcome with guilt. He felt it was his fault, even if, of course, it wasn't. He couldn't bear the idea of her knowing, and perhaps judging him. He told me I was old enough to keep a secret. She must never know, he said. He seemed so desperate, so sad. So I agreed to keep the secret.
And she still doesn't know? I whispered. He sighed again, deeply.
I'm not sure, Julia. She knew about the roundup. We all knew about the roundup. It had happened right in front of us. When she came back that evening, my father and I were so strange, peculiar, that she sensed something had taken place. That night, and many nights after, I kept seeing the dead boy. I had nightmares. They lasted till well into my 20s. I was relieved to move out of that apartment.
I think maybe my mother knew. I think maybe she knew what my father went through, how he must have felt. Maybe he ended up telling her because it was too much for him to bear. But she never talked to me about it.
And Bertrand? And your daughters and Colette?
They know nothing.
Why not? I asked. He put his hand on my wrist. It was frozen, its cold touch seeping through my skin like ice.
Because I promised my father, on his deathbed, that I would not tell my children or my wife. He carried his guilt within him for the rest of his life. He could not share it. He could not speak to anyone about it. And I respected that. Do you understand?
I nodded. Of course. I paused. Edouard, what happened to Sarah? He shook his head.
Between 1942 and the moment on his deathbed, my father never uttered her name. Sarah became a secret I never stopped thinking about. I don't think my father ever realized how much I thought of her, how his silence regarding her made me suffer. I longed to know how she was, where she was, what had happened to her. But every time I tried to question him, he would silence me. I could not believe that he no longer cared, that he had turned the page, that she no longer meant anything to him. It seemed like he had wanted to bury it all in the past.
Did you resent him for that? He nodded.
Yes, I did. I resented him. My admiration for him was tarnished forever, but I could not tell him. I never did.
We sat in silence for a little moment. The nurses were probably beginning to wonder why Monsieur Tézac and his daughter-in-law were sitting in that car for so long. Edouard, don't you want to know what happened to Sarah Starzinski? He smiled for the first time.
But I wouldn't know where to begin, he said.
I smiled, too. But that's my job. I can help you. His face seemed less haggard, less ashen. His eyes were suddenly bright, full of a new light.
Julia, there's one last thing. When my father died nearly 30 years ago, I was told by his attorney that a number of confidential papers were being held in the safe.
Did you read them? I asked, my pulse quickening. He looked down.
I glanced through them briefly, just after my father's death.
And? I said, breathlessly.
Just papers about the boutique. Stuff concerning paintings, furniture, silverware.
That's all? He smiled at my blatant disappointment.
I believe so.
What do you mean? I asked, baffled.
I never had another look. I went through the pile very fast. I remember being furious there was nothing there about Sarah. I resented my father all the more.
I bit my lip. So you're saying you're not sure there is nothing there?
Yes. And I've never checked since.
Why not? He pressed his lips together.
Because I didn't want to be certain there was nothing there.
And feel even worse about your father?
Yes,
he admitted. So you don't know what's in there for sure. You haven't known for 30 years.
No,
he said. Our eyes met. It only took a couple of seconds. He started the car. He drove like a bat out of hell to where I assumed his bank was. I had never seen Edouard drive so fast. Drivers brandished furious fists. Pedestrians scooted aside with terror. We did not say a word as we hurtled along, but our silence was a warm, excited one. We were sharing this.
We were sharing something for the first time. We kept looking at each other and smiling. By the time we found a place to park on the Avenue Bosque and rushed to the bank, it was closed for lunch hour, another typically French custom that aggravated me, particularly today. I was so disappointed I could have cried. Edouard kissed me on both cheeks, pushed me gently away.
You go, Julia. I'll come back at 2 when it opens. I'll call if there is something there.
I walked down the avenue and caught the 92 bus, which would take me straight to the office over the Seine. As the bus drove away, I turned around and saw Edouard waiting in front of the bank, a solitary, stiff figure in his dark green coat. I wondered how he would feel if there was nothing in the safe about Sarah, just masses of papers about old master paintings and porcelain. And my heart went out to him.
"Are you sure about this, Miss Jarmont?"
my doctor asked. She looked up at me from over her half-moon glasses. "No," I replied truthfully. "But for the moment, I need to make those appointments." She ran her eyes over my medical file.
"I'm happy to make the appointments for you, but I'm not certain you're entirely comfortable with what you have decided."
My thoughts ran back to last evening. Bertrand had been exceptionally tender, attentive. All night long, he had held me in his arms, told me again and again he loved me, he needed me, but that he couldn't face the prospect of having a child so late in life. He felt that growing older would bring us closer, that we would be able to travel often while Zoe was becoming more independent. He had envisaged our 50s like a second honeymoon. I had listened to him, tears running down my face in the dark. The irony of it all. He was saying everything, down to the very word, that I had always dreamed of hearing him say. It was all there, the gentleness, the commitment, the generosity. But the hitch was that I was carrying a baby he did not want, my last chance of being a mother. I kept thinking of what Charla had said.
"This is your child, too."
For years, I had longed to give Bertrand another child, to prove myself, to be that perfect wife that Tézac approved of, thought highly of. But now I realized I wanted this child for myself, my baby, my last child. I longed for its weight in my arms. I longed for the milky, sweet smell of its skin. My baby. Yes, Bertrand was the father, but this was my child, my flesh, my blood. I longed for the birth, for the sensation of the baby's head pressing down through me, for that unmistakable, pure, painful sensation of bringing a child into the world, albeit with pain, with tears. I wanted those tears. I wanted that pain. I did not want the pain of emptiness, the tears of a barren, scarred womb. I left the doctor's office and headed toward Saint-Germain, where I was meeting Hervé and Christophe for a drink at the Café de Fleurs. I hadn't planned to reveal anything, but they took one look at my face and gasped with concern. So out it came. As usual, they had opposite opinions. Hervé believed I should abort, my marriage being the most important matter. Christophe insisted that the baby was the crucial point. There was no way I could not have that child. I would regret it for the rest of my life. They became so heated that they forgot my presence and started to quarrel. I couldn't stand it. I stopped them by banging on the table with my clenched fist, making the glasses rattle. They looked at me with surprise. That wasn't my style. I excused myself, said I was too tired to go on discussing the matter, and left. They gawked at me, dismayed. Never mind, I thought. I'd make it up another time. They were my oldest friends. They'd understand. I walked home through the Luxembourg Garden. No news from Edouard since yesterday. Did that mean he had been through his father's safe and found nothing concerning Sarah? I could imagine the resentment, all the bitterness resurfacing. The disappointment, too. I felt guilty, as if this was my fault. rubbing salt on his old wound. I walked slowly through the winding, flowery paths, avoiding joggers, strollers, elderly people, gardeners, tourists, lovers, Tai Chi addicts, petanque players, teenagers, readers, sunbathers. The usual Luxembourg throng. And so many babies. And of course, every single baby I saw made me think about the tiny being I carried within me. Earlier on that day, before the doctor's appointment, I had talked to Isabel. She had been particularly supportive, as usual. The choice was mine, she had pointed out, no matter how many shrinks or friends I could talk to, no matter whose side I was looking at, whose opinion I was examining. It was my choice, bottom line, and that was precisely what made it all the more painful. There was one thing I did know. Zoe had to be kept out of this at all costs. She would be on vacation in a couple of days, ready to spend part of the summer with Charla's children, Cooper and Alex, on Long Island, then with my parents in Nahant. In a way, I was relieved. This meant the abortion would take place while she was away, if abortion was what I had finally agreed to. When I got home, there was a large beige envelope on my desk. Zoe, on the phone with a friend, shouted from her room that the concierge had just brought it up. No address, only my initials scrawled in blue ink. I opened it, pulled out a faded red file. The name Sarah leapt out at me. I knew instantly what the file was. Thank you, Edouard, I said to myself fervently. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Inside the file were a dozen letters, dating from September 1942 to April 1952. Thin blue paper. Neat, round handwriting. I read them carefully. They were all from a certain Jules Dufort, who lived near Orléans. Each brief letter was about Sarah, her progress, her schooling, her health. Polite short sentences.
Sarah is doing well. She is learning Latin this year. She had chickenpox last spring. Sarah went to Brittany this summer with my grandsons and visited the Mont Saint-Michel.
I assumed Jules Dufort was the elderly gentleman who had hidden Sarah after her escape from Bonne-la-Rolande and who had taken her back to Paris, the day of the horrible discovery in the cupboard. But why was Jules Dufort writing to André Tézac about Sarah, and in such detail? I couldn't understand. Had André asked him to? Then I found the explanation. A bank statement. Every month, André Tézac had his bank send money to the Dufort for Sarah. A generous sum, I noticed. This had gone on for 10 years. For 10 years, Edouard's father had tried to help Sarah, in his own way. I could not help thinking of Edouard's immense relief when he had discovered all this locked away in the safe. I imagined him reading these very letters and making this discovery. Here was his father's redemption at long last. I noticed that the letters from Jules Dufort were not sent to the Rue de Saint-Ange, but to André's old shop on the Rue de Turenne. I wondered why. Probably because of Mamet, I supposed. André had not wanted her to know, and he had also not wanted Sarah to know that he was giving her this money on a regular basis. Jules Dufort's neat script read,
As you have requested, your donations have not been revealed to Sarah.
At the back of the file, I came upon a wide manila envelope. I pulled out a couple of photographs. The familiar slanted eyes. The pale hair. How she had changed since that school portrait of June 42. There was a palpable sadness about her. The joy had gone out of her face. She was no longer a child. A tall, slim young woman of 18 or so. The same sad eyes, despite the smile. A couple of young men of her age were with her on a beach. I turned the photo over. Jules' neat handwriting read,
1950, Trouville, Sarah, with Gaspard and Nicolas Dufort.
I thought of all she had gone through, The Veldive, Bonne-la-Hollande, her parents, her brother. Too much to bear for a child. I was so wrapped up in Sarah Starzynski, I didn't feel Zoe's hand brush my shoulder.
Mom, who's that girl?
I hastily covered the photos with the envelope, muttering something about a tight deadline.
Well, who is it?
She asked. Nobody you know, honey, I said hurriedly, pretending to tidy my desk. She sighed, then said in a clipped, grown-up voice,
You're weird at the moment, Mom. You think I don't know. You think I don't see. But I see everything.
She turned and walked away. I felt guilt wash over me. I rose, caught her up in her bedroom. You're right, Zoe. I'm weird at the moment. I'm sorry. You don't deserve this. I sat down on her bed, unable to face her wise, calm eyes.
Mom, why don't you just talk to me? Just tell me what's wrong.
I felt a headache coming on, one of those powerful ones.
You think I won't understand, because I'm only 11, right?
I nodded. She shrugged.
You don't trust me, do you?
Of course I trust you. But there are things I can't tell you because they're too sad, too difficult. I don't want you to be hurt by these things, the way they hurt me. She touched my cheek gently, her eyes glistening.
I don't want to be hurt. You're right, don't tell me. I won't sleep if I know. But promise me you'll be all right soon.
I took her in my arms, held her tight. My beautiful, brave girl. My beautiful daughter. I was lucky to have her. So lucky. Despite the headache's onslaught, my thoughts lurched back to the baby. Zoe's sister or brother. She knew nothing. Nothing of what I was going through. Biting my lip, I fought back tears. After a while, she slowly pushed me away and looked up at me.
Tell me who that girl is. That girl in the black and white photos. The ones you were trying to hide from me.
All right, I said. But it's a secret, okay? Don't tell anyone. Promise? She nodded.
Promise. Cross my heart and all that.
Remember I told you I found out who lived in the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment before Mamie moved in? She nodded again.
You said a Polish family, a girl my age.
Her name is Sarah Starzynski. Those were photos of her. Zoe narrowed her eyes at me.
But why is it a secret? I don't get it.
It's a family secret. Something sad happened. Your grandfather doesn't want to talk about it. And your father doesn't know anything about her.
Did something sad happen to Sarah?
She said carefully.
Yes,
I replied quietly. Something very sad.
Are you going to try and find her?
She asked, sobered by my tone.
Yes. Why?
I want to tell her that our family is not what she thinks. I want to explain what happened. I don't think she knows what your great-grandfather did to help her, for 10 years.
How did he help her?
He sent her money every month, but he asked that she not be told. Zoe was silent for a moment.
How are you going to find her?
I sighed.
I don't know, honey. I just hope I do.
After 1952, there is no trace of her at all in this file. No more letters, no more photos, no address. Zoe sat on my knees, pressing her slim back against me. I took a whiff of her thick, shiny hair, the familiar, sugary, Zoe-like smell that always reminded me of when she was a toddler, and smoothed a couple of unruly strands down with my palm. I thought of Sarah Starzynski, who had been Zoe's age, when horror came into her life. I closed my eyes, but I could still see the moment when the policeman tore the children from the mothers at Bonne-la-Hollande. I could not get the image out of my mind. I held Zoe close, so close she gasped. Odd, the way dates go. Ironic, almost. Tuesday, July 16th, 2002. The Veldive commemoration. And precisely the date of the abortion. It was to take place in some clinic I had never been to, somewhere in the 17th arrondissement, near Mamet's nursing home. I had asked for another date, feeling July 16th was overloaded with meaning, but it had not been possible. Zoe, fresh out of school, was leaving for Long Island via New York with her godmother, Allison, one of my old friends from Boston, who often flew between Manhattan and Paris. I was to join my daughter and Charlotte's family on the 27th. Bertrand did not take his vacation till August. We usually spent a couple of weeks in Burgundy in the old Tézac house. I had never fully enjoyed my summers there. My parents-in-law were anything but relaxed. Meals had to be eaten on time, conversations kept mild, and children were seen and not heard. I wondered why Bertrand always insisted that we spend time there instead of going on a vacation, just the three of us. Luckily, Zoe got on well with Laure and Cécile's boys, and Bertrand played endless tennis matches with his brothers-in-law. And I felt left out, as usual. Laure and Cécile kept their distance year after year. They invited their divorced girlfriends and spent hours by the pool tanning studiously. The thing was to have brown breasts. Even after 15 years, I could still not get used to it. I never bared mine. And I felt I was laughed at behind my back for being the prude américaine. So I spent most of my days walking in the forest with Zoe, going on exhausting bike rides till I felt I knew the area by heart, and showing off my impeccable butterfly stroke while the other ladies languidly smoked and tanned in their minimal Erez swimwear that never went in the pool.
"They're just jealous French cows. You look too damn good in a bikini," scoffed Christophe whenever I complained of those painful summers. "They'd talk to you if you were riddled with cellulite and varicose veins."
He made me guffaw, yet I could not quite believe him. But I did love the beauty of the place, the ancient, quiet house that always felt cool, even during the fiercest summers, the large, rambling garden full of old oak trees, and the view on the curvaceous River Yonne, and the nearby forest, where Zoe and I would go for long walks, when as a baby she had been entranced by the chirp of a bird, a twig with a strange shape, or the murky sparkle of hidden marsh. The Rue de Saint-Ange apartment, according to Bertrand and Antoine, would be ready in early September. Bertrand and his team had done a great job, but I had not yet envisaged living there now that I knew what had happened. The wall had been pulled down, but I remembered the secret deep cupboard, the cupboard where little Michel had waited for his sister to come back, in vain. The story haunted me relentlessly. I had to admit I was not looking forward to living in the apartment. I dreaded nights there. I dreaded bringing back the past, and I had no idea how to prevent myself from doing so. It was hard not being able to talk to Bertrand about it. I needed his down-to-earth approach, longed to hear him say that despite the awfulness, we'd get over it, we'd find a way. I could not tell him. I had promised his father. What would Bertrand think of the whole story, I wondered, and his sister's? I tried to imagine their reaction, and Mamet's. It was impossible. The French were closed up like clams. Nothing must be shown. Nothing must be revealed. Everything was to remain unruffled, undisturbed. That's how it was. How it had always been. And I found it increasingly tough to live with. With Zoe gone to America, home felt empty. I spent more time at the office, working on a witty piece for the September issue about young French writers and the Parisian literary scene. Interesting and time-consuming. Every evening, I found it harder and harder to leave the office, put off by the prospect of the silent rooms that awaited me. I took the long way home, reveling in what Zoe called Mom's Long Shortcuts, enjoying the city's fiery beauty at sunset. Paris was beginning to take on that deliciously abandoned look it harbored from mid-July. Shops had rolled their iron grids down, with signs reading closed for vacation opening up September 1st. I had to walk for long stretches to find an open pharmacie, grocers, boulangerie, or cleaners. Parisians were taking off for their summer spree, leaving their city to indefatigable tourists. And as I walked home on those balmy July evenings, marching straight from the Champs-Élysées to Montparnasse, I felt Paris without its Parisians belonged to me at last. Yes, I loved Paris. I had always loved it. But as I strolled at dusk along the Pont Alexandre III, with the golden dome of the Invalides gleaming like a huge jewel, I missed the States with such poignancy that the pain seared right to the pit of my gut. I missed home, what I had to call home, even if I had lived in France for more than half my life. I missed the casualness, the freedom, the space, the easiness, the language, the simplicity of being able to say you to each and every person, not the complicated vous and tu I had never perfectly mastered and which still threw me. I had to admit it. I missed my sister, my parents. I missed America. I missed it like I had never missed it before. As I neared our neighborhood, beckoned by the tall, brown grimness of the Tour Montparnasse that Parisians love to hate, but that I was fond of because it allowed me to find my way back from any arrondissement, I suddenly wondered what Paris had been like under the occupation. Sarah's Paris. Gray-green uniforms and round helmets. The implacability of curfew and Ausweis. German signs posted up in Gothic lettering. Huge swastikas plastered over the noble stone buildings. And children wearing the yellow star. The clinic was a well-to-do, cushy place, with beaming nurses, obsequious receptionists, and careful flower arrangements. The abortion was to take place the following morning at 7. I had been asked to come in the night before, on July 15th. Bertrand had gone to Brussels to clinch an important business deal. I hadn't insisted for him to be there. I somehow felt better with him not around. It was easier to settle into the dainty, apricot-colored room alone. At another moment, I would have wondered why Bertrand's presence seemed superfluous. How surprising, considering he was part and parcel of my everyday life. Yet here I was, going through the severest crisis of my life without him, and relieved at his absence. I moved like a robot, mechanically folding my clothes, putting my toothbrush on the shelf above the basin, staring through the window at the bourgeois facades of the quiet street. "What the hell are you doing?" whispered an inner voice I had tried to ignore all day. "Are you crazy? Are you really going to go through with this?" I hadn't told anyone about my final decision. No one at all, apart from Bertrand. I did not want to think about his blissful smile when I told him I'd do it, the way he had pulled me close, kissing the top of my head with unrestrained fervor. I sat on the narrow bed and took the Sarah file out of my bag. Sarah was the only person I could bear thinking about right now. Finding her felt like a sacred mission, felt like the only possible way to keep my head up, to dispel the sadness in which my life had become immersed. Finding her. Yes. But how? There was no Sarah Dufour or Sarah Starzinski in the phone book. That would have been too easy. The address on Jules Dufour's letters was no longer in use. So I had decided to trace his children, or grandchildren, the young men in the Trouville photograph, Gaspard and Nicolas Dufour, men who would be in their mid-60s or early 70s, I guessed. Unfortunately, Dufour was a common name. There were hundreds of them in the Orléans area. That meant phoning each one of them. I had worked at it hard in the past week, spent hours on the internet, poring over phone books, making endless calls, and then facing disappointing dead ends. And then, that very morning, I had spoken to a Nathalie Dufour, whose number had been listed in Paris. A young, joyful voice had answered me, I went into the usual routine, repeated what I had said over and over again to strangers on the other end of the line. My name is Julia Jarmont. I'm a journalist. I'm trying to trace a Sarah Dufault, born in 1932. The only names I have are Gaspard and Nicolas Dufault. She interrupted me. Yes, Gaspard Dufault was her grandfather. He lived in Achères-le-Marché, just outside Orléans. He had an unlisted number. I held on to the receiver, breathless. I asked Nathalie if she remembered Sarah Dufault at all. The young woman laughed. It was a nice laugh. She explained that she was born in 1982, and she didn't know much about her grandfather's childhood. No, she had not heard of Sarah Dufault. At least, she didn't remember anything specific. She could call her grandfather if I liked. He was a gruff fellow. He didn't like the telephone. But she could do it and get back to me. She asked for my number. Then she said, "Are you American? I love your accent." I had waited for her call all day. Nothing. I kept checking my mobile, making sure the batteries were charged, that it was turned on properly. Still nothing. Maybe Gaspard Dufault was not interested in talking to a journalist about Sarah. Maybe I had not been persuasive enough. Maybe I had been too persuasive. Maybe I shouldn't have said I was a journalist. I should have said a friend of the family. But no, I couldn't say that. It wasn't true. I couldn't lie. I didn't want to. Achères-le-Marché. I had looked it up on a map. A small village halfway between Orléans and Pithiviers. The sister camp to Beaune-la-Hollande. Not far away, either. It was not Jules and Geneviève's old address. So it had not been where Sarah had spent 10 years of her life. I grew impatient. Should I call Nathalie Dufault back? As I was toying with the idea, the mobile rang. I grabbed it, breathed, "Hello?" It was my husband calling from Brussels. I felt disappointment jab my nerves. I realized I did not want to talk to Bertrand. What could I say to him? The night had been brief and restless. At dawn, a matronly nurse had appeared, a folded blue paper gown in her arms. I would be needing it for the operation, she smiled. There was also a blue paper bonnet and blue paper shoes. She would come back in half an hour, and I'd be wheeled straight to the operation room. She reminded me, still with the same hearty smile, that I was not allowed to drink or eat anything because of the anesthesia. She left, closing the door gently. I wondered how many women she was going to wake up this morning with that smile. How many pregnant women about to have a baby scraped out of their womb. Like me. I put the gown on. Docile. The paper felt itchy next to my skin. There was nothing else to do but wait. I turned the television on, zapped to LCI, the non-stop news channel. I watched, not concentrating. My mind felt numb. Blank. In an hour or so, it would be over. Was I ready for this? Could I cope with it? Was I strong enough? I felt incapable of answering those questions. I could only lie there in my paper dress and paper hat and wait. Wait to be wheeled into the operating room. Wait to be put to sleep. Wait for the doctor to perform. I didn't want to think about the exact movements he was going to undertake within me, between my opened thighs. I blocked the thought out fast, focused on a svelte blonde making professional sweeping motions with manicured hands over a map of France dotted with sunny round faces. I remembered the last session with the therapist a week ago, Bertrand's hand on my knee.
"No, we do not want this child. We both agree."
I had remained silent. The therapist had looked at me. Had I nodded? I couldn't remember. I remember feeling sedated, hypnotized. And then Bertrand in the car.
"That was the right thing to do, Amour. You'll see. It will soon be over."
And the way he had kissed me. Passionate, heated. The blonde vanished. An anchorman appeared, and the familiar jingle for the newsreel was heard.
"Today, July 16th, 2002,
marks the 60th anniversary of the Vélodrome d'Hiver roundup, in which thousands of Jewish families were arrested by the French police. A black moment in France's past. Quickly, I put up the sound. As the camera zoomed along the Rue Nélaton, I thought of Sarah, wherever she was now. She would remember today. She didn't need to be reminded. Ever. For her, and for all those families who had lost loved ones, July 16th was not to be forgotten. And this morning of all mornings, they would open eyelids heavy with pain. I wanted to tell her. Tell them. Tell all these people. How? I thought, feeling helpless, useless. I wanted to shout, to scream out to her, to them, that I knew, that I remembered, and that I could not forget. Several survivors, some of whom I had already met and interviewed, were shown in front of the Veldive plaque. I realized I had not yet seen this week's issue of Sen Scenes with my article in it. It was out today. I decided to leave a message on Bamber's mobile, asking him to have a copy sent to the clinic. I turned on my phone, eyes riveted to the television. Franck Lévy's grave face appeared. He talked about the commemoration. It was going to be more important than the previous years, he pointed out. The phone beeped, telling me I had voicemail. One message was from Bertrand, late last night, telling me he loved me. The next one was from Nathalie Dufour. She was sorry to be calling so late. She hadn't been able to phone before. She had good news. Her grandfather was intent on meeting me. He had said he could tell me all about Sarah Dufour. He had seemed so excited that Nathalie's curiosity had been aroused. Her animated voice drowned out Franck Lévy's level tones.
If you want, I could take you to Asher tomorrow, Tuesday. I could drive you there, no problem. I really want to hear what Papi has to say. Please phone me so we can meet somewhere.
My heart was beating fast, almost painfully. The anchorman was back on the screen, presenting another topic. It was too early to call Nathalie Dufour now. I'd have to wait a couple of hours. My feet danced with anticipation in their paper slippers. Tell me all about Sarah Dufour. What did Gaspard Dufour have to say? What would I learn? A knock on the door startled me. The nurse's garish smile jolted me back to reality.
Time to go, madame,
she said briskly, showing teeth and gums. I heard the stretcher's rubbery wheels squeak outside the door. All of a sudden, everything was perfectly clear. It had never been so clear, so easy. I got up, faced her. I'm sorry, I said quietly. I've changed my mind. I pulled the paper bonnet off. She stared at me, unblinking.
But, madame, she began.
I tore the paper dress open. The nurse averted shocked eyes from my sudden nudity.
The doctors are waiting, she said.
I don't care, I said firmly. I'm not going to do this. I want to keep this baby. Her mouth quivered with indignation.
I will send the doctor to see you immediately.
She turned and walked away. I heard the click of her sandals along the linoleum, sharp with disapproval. I slipped a denim dress over my head, stepped into my shoes, seized my bag, and left the room. As I scrambled down the stairs, past startled nurses carrying breakfast trays, I realized I'd left my toothbrush, towels, shampoo, soap, deodorant, makeup kit, and face cream in the bathroom. So what, I thought, rushing through the prim, tidy entrance. So what? So what? The street was empty with that fresh, gleaming look Parisian sidewalks boast early in the morning. I hailed a taxi and rode home. July 16th, 2002. My baby. My baby was safe within me. I wanted to laugh and cry. I did. The taxi driver eyed me several times in the rearview mirror, but I didn't care. I was going to have this baby. I made a rough estimate, counting over 2,000 people grouped by the Seine along the Bir Hakeim Bridge. The survivors. The families. Children. Grandchildren. Rabbis. The mayor of the city. The prime minister. The minister of defense. Numerous politicians. Journalists. Photographers. Franck Lévy. Thousands of flowers. A soaring marquee. A white platform. An impressive gathering. Guillaume stood by my side, his face solemn, his eyes downcast. Fleetingly, I recalled the old lady from the Rue Nélaton. What was it she had said?
Nobody remembers. Why should they? Those were the darkest days of our country.
I suddenly wished she could be here now, gazing at the hundreds of silent, emotional faces around me. From the stand, a beautiful middle-aged woman with thick auburn hair sang. Her clear voice rose above the roar of the nearby traffic. Then the Prime Minister began his speech.
60 years ago, right here in Paris, but also throughout France, the appalling tragedy began to take